Hello, everyone, and welcome. Welcome to the Awaken to Wholeness Summit. My name is Val Salidkar. Today, we are diving in with a very remarkable woman who has dedicated her life, her vision, her heart to this movement known as the Great Turning. And we're going to be talking about that in the next hour. Molly Young Brown. Molly is a writer, a workshop facilitator, and a life coach, and she draws her work from the work that reconnects eco-psychology, psychosynthesis, and systems thinking, all these terms that we're going to dive into and get to know intimately very, very soon. And she also co-authored with Joanna Macy, who is the founder of the work that reconnects, the guidebook called Coming Back to Life, both editions. There's a new recent edition that is just rich and fabulous. Molly has also published Growing Whole, Self-Realization for the Great Turning, Held in Love, Life Stories to Inspire Us Through Times of Change, This Moment, and Lighting a Candle, Collected Reflections on a Spiritual Life. It is such a deep honor to have you with us, Molly. Welcome.
Thank you.
I know, like, as soon as it hit me that I needed to do this project, this, you know, Awaken to Wholeness Summit, and how much our world needs to have this conversation. The first thing that came to mind was diving into the work that reconnects, how important it is, especially in this moment, you know, and our beloved Joanna, who is now 88 and an incredible elder in our world, such a wise woman, just isn't really doing interviews anymore, you know, and so it's definitely an honor and such a blessing to have you here as a leader in this movement and a lead trainer and facilitator in the work that reconnects. To say yes. I'm so happy you said yes and that you're with us. Thank you for that, Molly, because we really need this. We really need this.
Especially now.
I do. So your work, you know, we even in the intro, there's a lot of terms that I'm sure are not really household names or that familiar with for people. Psychosynthesis, you know, you actually wrote the first book in the United States about psychosynthesis and called Unfolding Self, you know, from this work, yes, Roberto Assagioli. And one of your main contributions to this work, which I also do, right? We speak the same language, right? Psychosynthesis, the work that reconnects. One of your main contributions was kind of weaving in the eco-psychology element, you know, really expanding our sense of self beyond ourselves, right? Into this larger identity, earth as lover, earth as self, right? And weaving that in to this movement of psychosynthesis. And then your life expanded even more into the work that reconnects. And I'd love to know a little more about that journey, how that unfolded for you, and how those different and very similar sort of, you know, invitations, how they dance together, how they inform each other in your work.
How far back shall I go, Val?
As far back as you want to go. Everything you share is going to enrich us. Yeah.
Well, I think I'll start with, like, when I was in college, as a, you know, a young person in college. And very early on, I met the man who became my husband and has continued to be my husband all these years. We've been married 55 years. And he was really interested in Zen Buddhism at the time, which was, this is back in the late 50s, early 60s. So it was like, not terribly well known. It was just starting, people were starting to wake up to there was this weird thing called Buddhism and what was it about and so on. And I was just, you know, he was taken with it. And so I became interested in it. And so then I was interested in psychology, but, you know, behaviorism and stuff like that. It was not, you know, I wanted something that brought the spiritual dimension into. So in the, when was it? About 60. Well, my, oldest son was born in 66, so it was before that that I found out about psychosynthesis, which is this started by Roberto Assagioli, an Italian psychiatrist, who said, how can you have a complete psychology if you don't include the spiritual dimension? And most psychologies of the time did not. Jung did, but not to the full extent, I think, that Assagioli did. And he didn't want to say what that was. He didn't want to define it. He didn't want to say, you know, set up yet another religion. We don't need that. We've got plenty. But something that would say, okay, here's this realm, and you can work in this realm however you want to. You can, whatever imagery, whatever teachings, whatever metaphors speak to you, go for them. But it exists, and it's important to our healthy, to have a healthy psychology, to have that realm included. Absolutely. So I just loved it. I said, oh yeah, right. So did Jim, my husband. So we studied it. And in 1973, we went to study with the founder, Roberto Assagioli, one summer. We left our small children with their grandparents and took 5 weeks and went to Italy. And, you know, a seminal event in my life. I was 31 or something like that at the time. Yeah, 31, 32. Yeah, 31. And just really ready for it. And it was a life-changing event. So psychosynthesis then became my practice. When I returned from there, I began to see clients. I lived in New Mexico, where there was no licensing for counselors or anything above at the master's level. The only thing that was there was if you were a PhD psychologist. Mm-hmm. But you could practice without a license because it was, you know, as long as you didn't call yourself a psychologist, you were fine. So I did. And used psychosynthesis very effectively for many years. Then in 1986, we moved to the Bay Area. And I had really gotten interested in peace psychology. How could our psychology, as we understand it, help us be more peaceful creatures, not only as individuals, but as societies? And I'd always been an environmentalist, always. So shortly after I got there, I met Joanna Macy, got to the Bay Area, and took a workshop with her. The first workshop I actually took with her was in 1990 on nuclear guardianship. Well, this gets back to my childhood. I grew up in Los Alamos, New Mexico, and my family moved there when I was 3 years old, just after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the bombs had been dropped there. And so I grew up in this, in many ways, an amazing town. The first place, it's right nestled in the mountains. It's a beautiful location. And, you know, there were more PhDs per capita than any place else in the United States, probably in the world. And so, I mean, the educational system, as you can imagine, was fantastic and so on. But there was something weird, and I started having stomach aches. And everybody just thought it was me. You know, I had either some physical problem or emotional problem that was showing up in terms of stomach aches. And it wasn't until years later that I realized that the stomach aches were because I knew something was off. So as I grew older and became more aware of what was actually going on in Los Alamos and that they were building weapons of mass destruction. And of course the thing was deterrence and all that, you know, all this rationalization. So when I met Nuclear Guardianship, it was like, this is what I need to do. I need to become involved in this movement to end our use of nuclear weapons and nuclear energy because of the waste products that are produced in that never go away. Right. Essentially never go away. I mean, 200,000 years is like never.
thinkers, we're not really in deep time thinking about our future generations when we make
right and what's going to happen when, you know, we have all this waste and it won't stay stored, whatever we do is going to leak, and so it's a huge problem. Anyway, so I went to this workshop, met Joanna. And, well, I'd met her before, but I, you know, met her again, and I said, this woman is my teacher. Yeah. And I'm going to do whatever I need to do to get next to her. So I joined the Nuclear Guardianship Project and worked with her. We had what we call the fire group. She calls nuclear energy the poison fire.
Yeah.
And so we had the fire group, and we met, I think, monthly, and figured out what we could do to raise the consciousness of the American people about this really, really severe problem.
And was Joanna also facilitating then the work that ReConnects?
Well, we didn't call it that then.
Despair and
empowerment. She called it, yeah, well, despair and empowerment was what it was first called. And then she called it deep ecology work. Mm. And it wasn't actually until we were writing Coming Back to Life, the first book in 1998, well, it was in the late 1990s, we decided to start calling it the work that reconnects. And I can remember that moment. Her husband, Fran Macy, a magnificent man, was talking with us, and we were saying, deep ecology work is too vague, and, you know, this is, besides, there's other kinds of deep ecology that isn't, you know, quite this. This is something more specific. And he said, well, what does it do? Well, it reconnects people to you know, to life itself and to their participation in life. So call it the work that reconnects.
Perfect. It's perfect.
So there it was.
To each other, to life. And
yeah. Yeah. Right.
So you had this psychosynthesis background and this practice, and then this world of the work that reconnects.
Right. And I felt they were completely compatible.
Wow.
One thing about psychosynthesis is that we learn that within an individual person's psyche, you can't throw anything away. You can't get rid of anything. If a person has a particular, we call them subpersonalities, that's problematic. You have to work with that subpersonality. You have to find what it's trying to do for you and what it needs, and you have to take care of what it needs and give it what it needs and appreciate what it has to offer. And your relationship with it just transforms. But you never get rid of it.
Yeah.
Just like we can never get rid of nuclear waste. You know, you can bury it in the ground, but it's going to come back and to haunt you. Same thing is true of in psychology. So, and the other thing about psychosynthesis and the work that reconnects is, in psychosynthesis, we learn about, we call it sometimes the transpersonal self, or we call it the universal self. And it's the sense that when we connect with our deepest self or our highest self or our best self or whatever you want to call it, that quote self is actually the whole enchilada. Mm-hmm. Yourself and myself are not separate. They're not different. We have different, it's almost like the facets of a diamond. You know, you have you're showing a different facet than I am, but it's still the same diamond.
Mm.
Which is that's so that's why I feel like psychosynthesis and the work that reconnects are so completely compatible. I've also spent a great deal of time and energy bringing the work that reconnects into psychosynthesis community. because it has tended to be a little bit focused on the individual. And I really have felt the need for us to realize there, in a way, there's no such thing as an individual, in a way.
It's true.
That we're, you know, we're all interrelated. Some kind of New Age teachings come, kind of end up saying, you know, you create your own reality, as if I existed somehow separately from everything else and could create this whole reality all by myself. And I realize that there's
eye at play here, right?
Yeah.
The great mystery.
So I just have continued to work with both systems, but of late, partly because of the crises we face in the world, I am focusing more on the work that reconnects and doing workshops and retreats. And frankly, I have a counseling practice or a coaching practice, and a lot of people that come because they know I have that emphasis, and they want to find out, you know, what's my role? What can I do to be of greater service to the world? And so I work with them on that.
And I find that that is one of the greatest questions that we're asking right now, you know, especially right now. Like, there's such an intensity. We say this all the time, but right now there is a particular intensity that we are all feeling, especially with the recent elections and just everything kind of coming to a head, you know, all mm-hmm. stuff just bubbling up to the surface. Things that we've been feeling on some level or another, but haven't quite identified or haven't quite talked about. And I think that there is this, I want to say, unnatural tendency to numb out or to run away because we're so afraid to speak what's here for ourselves. We're so afraid to feel what's here. So we look for all kinds of ways to run away and escape feeling, you know, mm-hmm. from addictions, you know, to overworking ourselves, to whatever it is, to not
shopping,
whatever it is, to not really be present with what that is. Mm-hmm. And right now, I think that what we're feeling, as we're saying, it's not our individual pain, it's a collective pain. And mm-hmm. we're together now for the first time and seeing it in each other, giving each other permission to feel more deeply, not just in these niche little areas where we're doing the work that reconnects or work like that, but right out here, wide open in our face that we cannot ignore. There is pain in this world, and it is collective pain. And I think that right now, more than ever, we need the work that reconnects and other works that are similar to that to invite us into this feeling, this deeper feeling, into the great turning. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about what's happening, this great unraveling and the great turning. These are terms that we use, right, in the work that reconnects and in our circle. So let's talk about that so people who are listening can understand exactly what's going on with that.
Yeah, I want to start with business as usual, because there's kind of three stories.
Yes.
And business as usual, the great unraveling, and the great turning. And business as usual has been the dominant. I mean, if you turn on television and you watch a news channel, or you pick up a magazine or whatever, it's like business as usual. We'll just keep going on. And if we have, you know, there's a natural disaster, which maybe aren't so natural anymore. We deal with it and then we, quote, get back to normal. We get back to business as usual. We rebuild and just keep going on the way we've been going on. And in a way, I think this election has blown that up because we can't say business as usual. And I live a real comfortable life. I don't know about you, but I live in Mount Shasta, Northern California. It's incredibly beautiful. And I can walk out my door and be in the woods, you know, and it's a small town. I can ride my bike to the store. And guess what? I go to the store and there's groceries to buy. I mean, things look pretty good. They look like they're functioning well enough, but we're finding out that underneath that business as usual, the great unraveling is happening. And the great unraveling is causing a lot of suffering. suffering of humans and suffering of other species. The great sixth great extinction is going on.
And that is not something that we talk about every day, that we're in the midst of a mass extinction that we haven't seen in 65 million years. That's not everyday news.
You know, that we're and all the people that voted for Trump are like suffering. They're angry. They're confused. They don't know why things are not going the way they've been promised. And they're looking for someone to blame. And they're looking for someone to save them.
And I think it's
beyond, we all do that to some extent.
I think it's beyond even saying like the people who voted for X, Y, or Z. You know, I think that there is this, we don't want business as usual. We want to shake it up, but we don't know really what that means. We just know that we don't want business as usual.
We don't like what's happening, but we don't know
what it is.
I think
that what Trump represented for some people was this shaking up the business as usual.
Yes, absolutely. Right?
But when we're in a space of desperation, if we grab that first thing, change is great, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be good unless we're really careful about what that means to shake up business as usual.
Right, right.
So here we are. Now we're like diving into the unraveling. We're just unraveling.
Right. And the unraveling has been happening for 525 years. I mean, if you go back to Columbus's discovery of America, you could say the unraveling started then for the indigenous people of the Americas.
And look at what we see right now with what's happening over at Standing Rock and all the indigenous.
They're like rising up and saying, enough is enough.
You know, like it's time for us to recognize what's really important in this world.
Right,
and every being has the right to clean water and clean air and healthy land for healthy food. And the earth has a right to her integrity. And we have to put the prophets to the side for a second and say, planet and people are more important than anything. And that doesn't mean we can't have a kind of conscious capitalism as long as we recognize that we put priorities first. And that is our land, our planet, each other.
And that, honestly, profits ultimately are totally dependent on having a healthy life support system.
Yes.
I mean, profits, money ain't going to do you no good if there's no clean air or if there's no clean water or not enough food.
Short-term, like I was saying, the short-term way of thinking about time. You know, everything's like right now. We don't open ourselves enough to bring in our ancestors' wisdom and the future ones that are depending on us as their ancestors to create a safe and sustainable world to move into.
Right.
And we don't think in those terms, and we are so disconnected from who we are and the depth that we are and the evolutionary journey that we've all been taking together. When we don't speak in those terms and we don't connect in those terms, we just completely forget ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we're able to do all these things because, you know, the earth is then an object and, you know, all of these things that we're doing don't really matter. Humans don't have that much power. You know, we start making up all these excuses to excuse away our behaviors that are coming from this deep ignorance. You know, it's like as Joanna says, a perception, right?
That is that deep ignorance of our interconnectedness. And interconnectedness is a big word that is kind of abstract, and I wish we could think up a better one. Maybe just connectedness is enough. Maybe we don't need to have inter on there.
Love, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, he says to interbe.
Interbeing is another one.
I can't be without the relationship to everything. There's no.
And I'm reading Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Kimmerer, and she uses the word reciprocity a lot. The idea that life exists through reciprocity.
Yeah.
And we humans tend to think that things, I've got actually a great quote from her. She says, we have constructed an artifice where we perpetrate the illusion that things we consume have just fallen off the back of Santa's sleigh, not been ripped from the earth. The illusion enables us to imagine that the only choices we have are between brands.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, that's what freedom has come to mean in America, the freedom to choose which kind of breakfast cereal you're going to buy.
Without really thinking about
how that's not freedom.
Yeah. You know, so, you wrote something in one of your books, actually, Molly, in Growing Whole. You said, without self-awareness, and now we're talking about that greater collective self, right? And mm-hmm. the deeper sense of self, we can only act out of conditioning and habit.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote that. It's, I think that's such an eloquent way of saying, like, when we're not really asking those deeper questions,
mm-hmm.
questioning our unexamined assumptions about things, like there's a place called away. I'm going to throw this away. Well, where is that? Somebody's backyard. Ultimately, my drinking water, like,
yeah,
you know, where is the way? There's no such place. And when we're not really questioning deeply, we just go on automatic. And right. these habits are very bad habits that are perpetrating this issue and creating more pain in our world without our even thinking about it, not even recognizing how each of us is contributing to that. And so the great invitation is to ask those deeper questions and see, how are we responsible and how can we be responsible?
And conditioning, you mentioned the word conditioning, isn't just from childhood. It's also coming at us over the television and radio and multimedia all the time. Advertising is conditioning. And we're all vulnerable to it. Of course we are. But there is a certain amount of self-awareness that can help people, question the advertisement. When we had small children, when our kids were small, I should say, we used to, you know, we might be watching television with them and a commercial would come on and we would just start making fun of it. And that was our way of letting them know that this was not truth, that the ad was, and we would make fun of the ads and
it's so good that you brought that to their awareness, because I don't think we as a society don't really think twice about it. I remember reading in one of Brian Swim's books, Brian Swim is a mathematical cosmologist for people who are listening who may not know him, who teaches at the California Institute of Integral Studies. He's an amazing man. And in one of his books, he wrote that by the time a child enters into kindergarten, on average, they've seen about 30,000 advertisements. About 5 or 6 years old, 30,000 advertisements for like regular TV watchers, you know, billboards, magazines, all the stuff that's around us, advertisements in general. And we don't check our mental environment enough. So yes, when we're not doing that deep self-inquiry and creating that self-awareness within us, we just take all these things to be true. We just operate in that business as usual. You know, we don't really inquire. And that's what I love about the work that reconnects, because it invites us into the deeper inquiry, our self-inquiry and our collective inquiry.
Right, right. And we should talk a little bit more about the work that reconnects. What is it? It's really a series of practices that Joanna has developed, but also many people have, her colleagues have developed. So she's very open to people creating new practices and sharing them with her and with other people. But they're based, I think there's a really fundamental principle in all these practices. You could call them exercises if you like, but we like to call them practices. It seems like it takes it a little more seriously. It's not doing calisthenics. It's a practice.
It's a deep dive.
A yoga practice or a... some other kind of meditation practice or whatever. Anyway, that there's an underlying principle, which is you're exploring your own experience, your own feelings, your own thoughts, your own ideas, but exploring them from a questioning, inquiry kind of way. And very little time is spent in a typical workshop where somebody is teaching at you.
Right.
I mean, we may explain some principles of systems thinking or something like that just to give a little, a context. But most of the practices have to do with people sharing their feelings with one another in a kind of structured way. Because, you know, if I said, okay, let's sit down and share our feelings, we wouldn't know what to say, you know? So we need some guidance and some help in doing that. So
the work has this beautiful spiral.
Right. And yeah, so we don't just, again, we don't just say, okay, let's explore our feelings. We tend to start with gratitude. And this is actually based on a lot of indigenous traditions, especially in Northern America, where every meeting of any council or anything like that was started with thanksgiving, with giving thanks, with gratitude for what has been given and what we have received. So when we start with gratitude, people actually don't have much trouble with that. It's pretty easy to, and we don't usually say, what are you grateful for? For example, we might start with a group and we might go around and everybody introduces themselves and says one thing they love about life. Mm. And by the time you get around the room, everybody's glowing. Because what everyone else has said applies, you know, somebody will say, well, I love sunsets. And yeah, I love sunsets too. You know, I don't know if it's ever occurred that somebody said they love something that other people went, ugh, I don't like that. You know, I suppose if you said, I don't know, I like steak and somebody's a vegetarian, they might not like it. But people tend not to speak on that kind of a very specific level. They tend to speak in universals. Yeah. So gratitude, we begin with gratitude. And what that does is it opens our hearts. Mm. And as soon as we open our hearts, we also start to feel pain, because what we're grateful for, we're also seeing getting lost, getting destroyed, unraveling, and or being threatened in some way. So it's sort of a natural transition then to move into honoring our pain for the world. And it might be individual pain that is being spoken of, but it almost always is related to the world pain. Somebody has been through a bout of cancer and has had to deal with cancer. Where did that cancer come from? Probably from the environment. I don't know that any cancers are totally self-generated. They, you know, maybe from stress, which comes from the environment, or from actual toxins in the environment, which may have triggered it. So that's an example of the individual and the universe and the collective being related. But usually in the practices we do, the people tend to speak, again, in more universal terms. We do something called open sentences. And in an open sentence, I might say, okay, the first open sentence is something that troubles me about the world today is. And then everybody, they're usually in pairs at this point, says to their partner, something that troubles me about the world is. And they don't rehearse. They just look and see what comes out of their mouths. Is, you know, the degree of hatred that I'm seeing, you know, manifested, and racism that I'm seeing manifested in the world. And it just breaks my heart. And then you talk more about it. You know, you don't just stop at the end of that sentence. You talk for 2 or 3 minutes or maybe even longer. And then the other person says, what breaks my heart about the world, or what troubles me about the world is. And so, in first place, you connect deeply with that person, because how often do we do that? Mm. How often do we, in polite conversation, start talking about what really matters to us and what troubles us? You know, that's a way to spoil a dinner party. Actually, it wouldn't be a way to spoil it. It would be a way of bringing a dinner party to a great, a much deeper place.
You know, and that's the invitation right now, is for us to go into that place of being raw and real and our hearts breaking open to say, this is right. Who we are. And I think when we get to that point with ourselves and with another is when the conversation really begins.
Right. That's when it really begins. And the act of doing that is connecting in itself. Because as soon as we start talking about what really matters to us and what really troubles us, we're connecting.
Absolutely.
And because in the same way that gratitude connects, so does, interestingly enough, honoring our pain. And we use that term, honoring our pain, because it's honoring it. We are feeling this pain because we are connected. You know, if you see a child being abused on the street by an angry parent, you feel it.
Absolutely.
Well, why do you feel it if that's just somebody else's kid and I don't give a damn?
Because it's part of our larger body, right?
It's exactly.
Our connectedness with life.
And the same way with when we see, I think people get really upset about polar bears and the pictures we see of polar bears starving on icebergs because they can't, you know, get to land and get food. I mean, that breaks anybody's heart. But for some reason, polar bears have gotten a lot more attention than maybe some species of salamander that's going extinct too. Because, you know, big white bears are more, what do they call them? Macro, there's a term for it, charismatic macrovertebrates. Polar bears are more charismatic than the salamanders, shall we say.
But you know, when we talk about what's happening right now with the extinction of animals, and we talk about the polar bears, we're talking about animals that are African elephants and lions and sharks. And I mean, that are just, how can you imagine a world without these animals? And they are in danger right now.
Right.
You know, have people out there not believing that there's global climate change and not believing, you know, that humans are contributing, that we are that big enough of a force that we actually contribute to not only the degradation of our planet, but to the course of evolution itself. We affect the chemical composition of our atmosphere, therefore we affect every living thing on planet Earth. I mean, like, we have that kind of...
Because we are interconnected. We can't do anything without its affecting all kinds of stuff. And we've been taught not to pay any attention to that because we want to be good little consumers, or the powers that be want us to be good little consumers.
And there's this overstimulation in our world. We're always looking for that next shiny thing, right? Mm-hmm. We barely keep our focus with all the with all the stuff happening.
Interesting thing is, when we let ourselves feel the pain, when we do that, we get non-intellectually, we get in a holistic sense that we are connected. And we actually feel more joy. It's really interesting. Ever since I've been doing the work that reconnects, since 1987, I think I had my first experience with it. The more I do it, the more joyful I am. It's crazy, but it's true.
Because
when I walk out and I see a beautiful flower blooming, I'm open to it. Because my heart's open and I can feel it. I can see its beauty, and it can give me a shot, just as good a shot as taking a stiff drink, only better because there's no hangover.
And you know what the beauty of that is, you know, I'm thinking about a particular exercise, and I've only been facilitating the work for about a decade, not nearly as long as you, but I've been in so many circumstances, even particular exercises. And I'll tell you, in the last few months, I've had a lot of my clients and friends come to me in pain, asking for support. And I have actually been able to hold space with a truth mandala, which is one of the exercises in the work that reconnects. In this you know, section of honoring our pain for the world, and this beautiful ritual that brings us into our fear and our sadness and our anger and our sense of emptiness or hopelessness, you know, grounded in hope. And it creates this container where we can dive in and explore in a very honest and raw way, what is alive for us, either in the personal or the collective sense. And when we do that, we, as you know, Joanna explains, as you explained so beautifully too, is that there is that other side of understanding, you know, that our sadness comes because we are in love so deep with life. And our anger comes because we are so passionate for justice and for what is right and good in this world, you know, and our emptiness allows us to be filled. It allows us to be a vessel to be filled.
Right? And to be open to new possibilities that we can't see.
Yes.
When we think we know all the answers.
Beautiful. And our fear gives us.
There's one more, isn't there?
Fear, which opens fear. Our courage, right? The courage to speak our fear, the courage to admit what's alive inside of us in a world that tells you to put it away. And so what a beautiful ritual this has been to hold us right now, especially right now in this moment.
And it's done in a group. One of the aspects of the work that reconnects is that it is primarily done in a group, in a community, in a container of, because we got into this together. We have to get out of it together. I can't save the world. You can't save the world. And in fact, you and I together can't save the world, but we can do our part and support one another. And somehow the Truth Mandala is a good example, because I am speaking, you know, I go into the center of the Truth Mandala with these possibilities of fear and anger and grief and so forth. And I can speak any of those or all of them as I choose. And I find myself being more passionate about my feelings than I ever do by myself, somehow being witnessed and held in expressing those. I feel safe doing it. It's interesting. I feel safe. If I'm by myself, I'd think, oh, I'll just freak out and never come back, you know, or something. I don't know. But in a container like that, I can cry my deepest tears and nobody tells me they're there now, dear. It'll be all right.
No, you're not okay. Be with that.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, and also, like, if you don't, even if you're not in the circle, you're in the circle, right? So if somebody is speaking out what's alive for them, the pain that they're experiencing, whatever it is that's alive for them in that moment, we connect because we share so much of that same, you know, psychological and spiritual and emotional space. We share that together. So it really is the beginning of a conversation that becomes so empowered. And so there's the joy, because when we can feel that deeply, the you know, the sadness of our world, now we've opened ourselves to the love. You can't have one without the other, right?
That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. There's a collision right now. It's been going on actually for, like I said, at least 500 years, maybe 1,000 years. I don't know. Maybe it goes back to the beginning of the agricultural revolution. But there's sort of two worldviews, and I'm oversimplifying because, of course, there's a lot of overlap and so forth. And one is the competitive, I'm me versus you. I got to look out for old number one. I got to, you know, be competitive. I got to grab what I want and take it, or I will lose it. I think it's called a zero-sum game. If I win, you lose, and so forth. And I mean, we're seeing that in Standing Rock right now, where you have a militarized police force using bullets, tear gas, mace, rubber bullets. Thank God they haven't killed anybody with a live round yet. They have them there. Huge tanks. I mean, it's unbelievable, against unarmed, peaceful protesters, or water protectors, as they call themselves.
Right.
So you've got the militarized police representing this competitive fight for everything you need worldview. And you have the indigenous people and their non-Indigenous brothers and sisters who have joined them, who are saying, we just want to protect the land and the water and the air for everyone. We all need this.
Yes.
And they are coming from that sense of deep connectedness and deep reciprocity, that word I used before, that there's an exchange in life, that it isn't just one way. We don't just mine the earth for everything we can get. We do, we can, but we're destroying our life support system in the process. So these two worldviews are just like right here, right in front of us all.
And that's what we're talking about, this new paradigm, right? Like, we're not a new even really, but like moving into this awareness of self.
It's an ancient paradigm, actually. It's an ancient paradigm.
An ancient paradigm infused with modern wisdom and technology and like what we-
And science.
And science, right? We as a human species are capable of so much. It's amazing what we're capable of doing. And when we think in terms of sustainability, when we think in terms of honoring what's sacred and holy and good and right and healthy in this world, you know, and we take our technology behind that, can you imagine?
So that's going into the next stage of the spiral of the work to reconnect, which is seeing with new eyes. And when we honor our pain, when we express our gratitude and honor our pain, we do start to see with new eyes. We do start to see just how interconnected we are and how it can't be us versus them, because there is no them. There's only us. And that applies to more than human beings, or some people call them non-human, some people call them more than human, plants, animals, ecosystems, rivers, mountains, etc.
And that's the beauty of the protectors, is that there, and I love that they made that distinction. We are not protesting, we are protecting, and we are praying. And so the movements that are happening there are all based in a prayerful romance with earth, with life, you know, with honoring what is sacred. And that's why, like, defend the sacred to me, like, that's the heart of it right there. Defend the sacred. How do you argue against that?
You know? Well, as you say that, I realize that's probably why there's such an extreme militarized response. This is very threatening to business as usual. This is very threatening to corporate profits, that we should be in love with the earth and in love with our life, you know, well, with the earth, that'll do. That's subversive. That's revolutionary. That's very threatening to, you know, the desire to just rip what we want from out of the earth and leave somebody else to clean up the mess.
It may be inconvenient for them. What inconvenience it is to live in a dirty world that we can't raise our children in, that we can't breathe in, that we can't eat healthy food in. Our bodies are suffering. Our world is toxic. Our inner world is toxic. Like, everything is a reflection of everything else. I mean, we see the physical evidence of our interconnectedness in our pain. And if that doesn't wake us up to seeing with new eyes, right?
Like, it does.
We're
it does.
Into this is our exploration, the reconnection of self and world. And we're getting it. We're getting that the world is our self.
Right.
The self is our world.
Mm-hmm.
It's all one thing. And I don't mean that in the New Agey sense. I mean, literally, it is connected.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what do we do with all of this? I mean, you know, how do we participate, Molly? How do we?
Well, then we move into the fourth phase of the spiral, which is going
full. We've gone into gratitude, right? We've gone into gratitude. We've gone into honoring our pain. We're seeing with new eyes. We're recognizing this crisis of perception. We're recognizing the sacred, ourselves connected to life and earth. And now it's going.
And we're going to go forth, and we're going to act on behalf of life. And one of the important, again, for me, one of the important things about the work that reconnects is we don't give prescriptions. don't say, okay, we're going to go forth now. Everybody come and we're going to go down and we're all going to go to Standing Rock together and, you know, demonstrate, or we're all going to do this, that, the other thing. We have to find our own paths because we all come from a different, you know, yeah, we're all interrelated. We're all interconnected. And I have my life experiences and my talents and my abilities and my limitations, and you have yours, and they're different. So
thank goodness, right? We can complement each other. Together we turn right. The wheel, right? Each of us has a spoke on the wheel.
For me, I think I inherited from my father, and I don't know whether it's genetic or environmental, but he was a writer, and I've been a writer since I was in first grade. I wrote my first novel when I was in first grade. Well, it wasn't a novel. It was a short story. But I wrote my first novel in fourth grade. And interestingly enough, I haven't written fiction ever since. I've written, my writing is nonfiction always. But that seems to be where, what my going forth primarily is, not entirely, obviously, and teaching and leading workshops and so forth. I've done very little direct action, although back in the Vietnam War days, I was out there marching with everybody else. But I live in Mount Shasta, so we have occasional little demonstrations here, but it doesn't have a huge amount of impact because, you know, 40 people marching around in a town of 3,000 is, it's just not very impactful.
Would,
but anyway,
on that note, just to say something, is that sometimes we have these grand visions of every single one of us coming together and doing this action, and the reality is that, like you're saying, just to kind of tag on to that, you know, each of us have our own unique gifts and our own unique ways of coming together, and so we find others that are similar, and maybe we'll create those actions together that can magnify the impact.
Absolutely.
The real movement happens in the way that we show up in our unique ways, and everybody doing that little bit, everybody doing that little
that
bit.
They are called to. I like to use the word calling, because calling is like from within. What am I called to? And it's almost as if we're all part of this incredible system, but just like the body is a system of systems, and you wouldn't expect the lungs to start digesting food. In fact, if you put food in your lungs, you choke because the lungs have a different function. And in that same way, we have to find out what our particular function is and do that. And it may change over time too. You know, we may do one thing for a while and then we do something else as we get into a different station in life. When I was pregnant with my second child, People's Park was happening in Berkeley, and I lived in Berkeley. And there were demonstrations and marches, and my husband went to them, but I didn't because I was pregnant, and I wasn't going to endanger my unborn child, you know, because things could get violent, and often did. I didn't want to be breathing tear gas if I was pregnant, you know, for example, things like that. So you do what is appropriate for you to do according to your responsibilities as well as your gifts and your limitations.
And that, you know, brings in another aspect of the work that reconnects, which is the three dimensions of how we take part.
Like, so good.
Earth, right? There's these three dimensions in the work that reconnects that invites us. And you know, one of them is holding action. So that's what we're talking about. When we think about like the typical activists, we think about those demonstrations and the direct action, civil disobedience, and all the things that I've done, a million things in my life, like definitely have, you know, for almost 20 years been involved in a lot of that, actually, even recently, you know, in organizing protests and ways to slow down and stop the things that are happening now that are creating this pain in our world.
Mm-hmm.
But that's only one dimension.
That's right. And the second dimension is creating new structures, new systems, new institutions. And sometimes they're not new. Standing Rock is doing both. They're doing a holding action. They're trying to stop that damn pipeline. But they're also creating this amazing community, all these camps that are developing and the way people are feeding each other and taking care of each other and bringing other people in, that is creating a model of how we can live together in harmony and reciprocity and mutual care. So that's another aspect of the Great Turning, is creating new slash old institutions and ways of living.
Yeah, and one
farmers markets.
Yes, permaculture design.
Permaculture, eco villages, time banks. There's so many examples.
Yeah.
Barter. There's so many examples of ways that people are creating.
And even when we're facilitating the work, I mean, we're taking part in this as an action.
Right.
Educators and facilitators and guides, like all of that is, you know, taking part in creating new ways of being.
Right.
That again, we're pulling from.
And they're also contributing to the third dimension. And these are not in order. I mean, they're all important. They all feed into each other. In fact, one example I've seen is a Venn diagram where you have, you know, because they all overlap.
They all overlap.
So anyway, the third dimension is the shift in consciousness.
Yeah.
Because that is absolutely essential. We can't keep doing things. I mean, if we are still holding the competitive us versus them point of view, and it's really hard not to fall into that during an election, for one thing, we have to shift our consciousness. The cool thing is taking part in holding actions and building new institutions is a great way to shift your consciousness. And as your consciousness shifts, then you can see new ways of doing those things so that the holding actions are from a higher state of consciousness, shall we say, or a more inclusive state of consciousness. So those are the three dimensions of the Great Turning, and they all interact. And we find our ways to go forth in any and or all or a combination of those three dimensions. Some people are really like to be on the front lines, and they're going out and doing the holding actions. And there might come a time, I haven't done a whole lot of holding actions, to be honest, but they're trying to build a water bottling plant in this town. And I've been working more on the kind of changing institutions level and shifting consciousness level. But there might come a time when I just go down there and be with other people to blockade the place. I don't know, but I certainly hold that possibility, and that would be the holding action aspect. So we move through these dimensions rather fluidly. Right. And I would ask the people who are watching this, think about what you are doing right now, what you're already doing for the Great Turning, that you're already contributing to one of these dimensions or more than one.
Right. It could be being a mother is an amazing way of contributing as well. You know, like
absolutely.
It doesn't have to be these big grandiose movements or, you know, there's so many things that we can do, tiny and large, to contribute and be part.
And nowadays with the amount of hate and racism that is happening right now, we all need to be ready to stand up for anyone who is being targeted in hate, in the grocery store, on the bus, at a bus stop, on the street.
We
need to be ready to stand up and intervene in a loving and kind way and to be allies for anyone. I mean, you and I are both nicely white. We're probably not going to be attacked. And I'm a grandmother, so I'm even less likely to be attacked. But I can be really alert to anything like that happening. Thank God, probably not in my little town, but it could.
Yeah.
And
is that when it's happening to anyone, it's happening to all of us.
That's right.
And that's that That's what we're recognizing here. And that right. is part of that dance, that interconnectedness with life. You know, and all the things that we've been talking about, you know, is this invitation to become more deeply aware of ourselves, this invitation into wholeness, right? Recognizing how we are not separated. Wholeness means specifically the way that we are woven together in this fabric, you know, of life, like the way that we dance together in the web of life. You know, that is the wholeness of our world, our inner world, our outer world. You know, and that's that invitation that you and Joanna wrote about so eloquently in the work that reconnects in coming back to life. You know, is and coming back to life means feeling that deeply, means recognizing
coming back to life.
Back to life.
Coming alive again.
Molly, I'd because... love to go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to invite you, you know, we're talking a lot about this, and I think a central theme of what we've been talking about today is our ability to feel that deeply, you know, and allowing that to move us into some kind of sacred action, you know, participating in the great turning in some way, tiny or large. And we talked about this beautiful sort of meditation, which is an amazing tool of breathing through.
You know, we have time for it?
We have time for it.
Okay.
A little bit short, but yeah, I really would like
I'll do a short version. Okay, the breathing through is just wonderful because we always have our breath. We're always breathing. So if you could just imagine closing your eyes, the people that are watching this, maybe find a comfortable place that, so that you're relaxed and alert in your chair. And just pay attention for a moment to your breath. The wonder, the miracle of your breath as it comes in through your nose and down your throat and into your lungs, and then back out again. Comes in and goes out. You can imagine your breath like a ribbon that comes in and flows down through your bronchi into your lungs, and then back out again. But for the purpose of this little meditation, I'd like you to imagine that it flows, your breath also flows through your heart, which indeed it does, because obviously your lungs exchange oxygen with your bloodstream. So imagine that this ribbon of air comes in and goes down and into your heart. But your heart is open, so it can flow back out again into the larger world. So it comes in and down and through your heart and back out again. Now, as you imagine that happening, you can imagine that something that is really troubling you in the world today, something that breaks your heart, let the images of that come into your mind's eye, or the feelings that you feel in relation to that. Let yourself feel the heartbreak, the sadness, the anger, the fear, even the numbness. And imagine that you can breathe that in into your huge, enormous open heart, and back out into the larger world. So you don't have to hold on to it. You can let it flow through you and back out to the larger world, which can help you hold it, help you be with it. So you breathe it in through your heart and back out. You can do the same with gratitude and joy. You can breathe that in and through your heart, and share that with the rest of the world as well. So when you find yourself confronting a painful situation in the news or in your direct experience, remember to practice this, breathing it in through your heart and then letting it go back out. So one more deep breath. to allow that to happen. Actually, this is very useful if you find yourself angry too, just to breathe that in and let it go back out. But breathe it through your heart. It needs to go through your heart.
Thank you, Molly. It just, what just came through for me is a quote actually by Joanna Macy. And she says something like, the heart that can break open can hold the entire universe.
Yes, yes.
And that's what it feels like too, like when we're feeling the intensity of our world and we're just like, oh, we feel like we're just shattering. To use this breathing through, to breathe it through and to let it move through our heart and know that the heart can hold it. It's not an object that can break, right? It's just this.
Well, it can break, but it breaks open.
You know what I mean? Like not physically, like we can hold anything and everything.
Yeah.
A huge capacity. We have an endless capacity because it's not just us holding it alone. We're all.
That's right.
There's this great expansion that happens within us. Thank you for that. And you know, I really, you know, we're, everything about the work that we connect and all that we've been talking about is really centered in this movement of the Great Turning. So I thought it would be beautiful to end with this poem by Christine Fry, The Great Turning. And just give people.
I think I know the poem, but you say it because you know it by heart, baby.
I don't know by heart.
Well, you have it in front of you. I don't have it in front of me, but I think I know the poem.
I really thought we would bring that as a.
Great.
Bring all of this together because it really gives us a sense of what this is and how we are connecting ourselves to the world, to each other, to life, how we're coming back to life and our wholeness. So I'm going to read most of the poem because there's an ending point that I feel like is just beautifully poetic and we'll stop there. The Great Turning by Christine Fry. You've asked me to tell you of the Great Turning, of how we saved the world from disaster. The answer is both simple and complex. We turned. For hundreds of years, we had turned away as life on Earth grew more precarious. We turned away from the homeless men on the streets, the stench from the river, the children orphaned in Iraq, the mothers dying of AIDS in Africa. We turned away because that is what we had been taught, to turn away from our pain, from the hurt in another's eyes, from the drunken father or the friend betrayed. Always we were told in actions louder than words to turn away. Turn away. And so we became a lonely people, caught up in a world moving too quickly, too mindlessly toward its own demise, until it seemed as if there was no safe place to turn, no place inside or out that did not remind us of fear or terror, despair and loss, anger and grief. Yet, on one of those days, someone did turn. Turn to face the pain. Turn to face the stranger. Turn to look at the smoldering world and the hatred seething in too many eyes. Turn to face himself, herself. And then another turned, and another, and another. And as they wept, they took each other's hands until whole groups of people were turning, young and old, gay and straight, people of all colors, all nations, all religions, turning not only to the pain and hurt, but to the beauty, gratitude, and love, turning to one another with forgiveness and a longing for peace in their hearts. And that.
May it be so. May it be so.
May it be so. Mm-hmm. Molly, thank you so much. I don't know, is there any last thoughts you have that you want to share? I also want you to share your gift with everyone that you're gifting for this summit.
I don't know. The words come to me. Take heart. Mm. Take heart. In these difficult, frightening, terrifying times, take heart.
That's beautiful and perfect. And I'm just feeling with you.
And my gift an MP3 of some guided exercises from psychosynthesis. And it's called Growing Whole, which is the name of the book that, by the same title. That's the book. And then, so the exercises from that book are in this MP3, beautiful, in my voice, you know, my guiding it. Wonderful. And there's also with that a PDF of a study guide that, you know, where it asks you questions and you can journal and so forth, respond to the questions after you've listened to the exercises. So it's a way of doing some of this work on your own, knowing that when you do, you're still connected to everyone else and to everything else.
Yes. Thank you so much, Molly. And you guys can click on that link near the video and receive those beautiful gifts from Molly. Molly Young Brown. It'll bring you to her website. You can explore her work a little bit more. Molly, thank you for you, the beautiful gift that you are to our world. And as a leader in this movement of the Great Turning and the work that reconnects. And it's wonderful to be on this journey with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Val. I've really enjoyed our conversation. It's been great.
Much love.
Take care. Yeah.